I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Igrača sa fantastično jakim udarcem Sinišu Mihajlovića. Mihajlović je...
The European Community's peace conference, widely seen as the last chance to solve the Yugoslav crisis, opened today with a warning from its chairman, Lord Carrington, that there are considerable difficulties ahead.
Pančev, Pančev prema Jugoviću, Jugović prema Biliću, evo Bilić!
Just how considerable was demonstrated by an angry exchange between the two warring factions. Croatia's president accused Serbia of waging a dirty, undeclared war. Serbia's president said the Croatians were trying to install a totalitarian regime in violation of human rights.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Jonathan Wilson is with me. And with us today is Rafa Honigstein, football journalist and writer for The Athletic and contributor to BT Sport, among others. Rafa, pleasure to have you in the studio.
Pleasure's all mine.
Now, today we go back to the European Cup semi-final second leg in 1991. Zvezda 2, Bayern 2. Zvezda, of course, going through 4-3 on aggregate to set up a final between them and Marseille. But why, Rafa, have you specifically gone for this semi-final second leg between Zvezda and Bayern?
You have to ask Jonathan, because for me it's extremely painful. This game, I didn't want to be here.
We appreciate you very much being here, you know, being fodder.
we'll let people behind the curtain.
The iron curtain.
This is
this is maybe my favourite game ever. I think it's a brilliant game of football. And because Bayern and Zvezda, and feel free to call them Red Star if you want, we're not fussy. Because they played each other in the group stage of Champions League, we'd had a conversation about the game in 91. And I said, do you want to come on and do it? So that's why we've dragged them here.
The sacrificial lamb, you know, Rafa Hoddingstone.
Psychologically, it might be good for you to talk it out.
Because you're a Bayern fan, of course, right?
I left the house this morning and two men were waiting for me to put a hood on my face.
Was it the black car? Was it the black car, was it?
Yeah. If you've got contact and serve, you might as well use them. That's what I always say.
Absolutely right.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, an extraordinary game and against two great sides, of course. I mean, so much to say, Jonathan, on this game. The background of this game, obviously, more specifically for the Zvezda point of view, is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I think what makes the game great is not just that this is the Zvezda team is a great team, but I think they knew it was the end. They knew if they didn't do it this time, they would never do it because tensions in the region had been mounting for several years. You had Slovenia and Croatia both declaring independence unilaterally in the months leading up to this. You'd had the first casualties of the Yugoslav civil war when the Croatian army clashed with Serb militia in Plitvice National Park. Happened just after the quarterfinal. Then between the two legs of a semi-final, Croatian nationalists fired ambush missiles in Borovo, which is a village outside Vukovar where Sniša Mihajlović grew up. So the war is, having gone from being extremely likely, has become totally inevitable and has arguably already started. And so I think the scenes you see at the end of this game, when there's the most extraordinary pitch invasion, and it's this sort of, there's a real sort of manic intensity to it, and people start ripping up the pitch. And, you know, they take the pitch away as souvenirs, and you know, they rip down the goalposts. And symbolically, this is the end of Yugoslav football. And this team, although Zvezda certainly had strong nationalist elements, certain nationalist elements among their support. If you look at the team itself, it is a pan-Yugoslav team. Mm. Yeah, there are Serbs, there are Macedonians, there are Bosnian Muslims, there are Montenegrins, there is a Croatian, albeit one with one Serbian parent in Bosneski. So there's no Slovenians, but everybody else is represented. So this is, if you like, the Yugoslav ideal in footballing form. And that's why that final 20 minutes is the most hectic back and forth 20 minutes you'll ever see. Uh-huh. But we'll come back to that.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, Rafa, the game is, you know, Bayern got a number of West German internationals. West Germany won the World Cup, of course, the previous year, 1990. This is a very good Bayern side.
Yeah, this is a good Bayern side. And for them, I think there was a similar outcome as far as the team breaking up was concerned. But of course, they didn't really know it at the time. And there wasn't a political dimension to it. But this was a Bayern team and a club that had been, ever since 1976, obsessed with winning the European Cup again and had suffered some really fairly traumatic defeats and finals. The 1982 final against Aston Villa, the 1987 final against Porto. They went close against Milan the season before, played pretty well against one of the best teams in the history of European football. And they probably felt that, you know, Red Star, yes, they had some decent players, but we are Bayern, we have these World Cup winners, we have Kohler, we have Reuter, we have Effenberg.
Augenthaler.
It's pretty
Torn, Laudrup. I mean, it's a great side.
Pretty good team with Jupp Heynckes, you know, being a pretty young manager who was going places at that time. But it all kind of fell apart in the first leg. Mm. I mean, they go into the second.
Well, the first leg is itself an extraordinary game.
Yeah, because they lose at home, and I still remember sitting in Olympic Stadium and thinking, "You know,
Were you there? Okay.
Who are these people? You know, who are these players? You know, who's this guy who just always steps on the ball then drags it back, and two Bayern players in midfield don't know what's going on?
Gone. And who was that? Poznanski?
I loved the drag back.
He had that one trick, but it just completely bamboozled Bayern. I mean, he actually had
a better ginger mullet than Effenberg did as well, which must have been very off-putting.
Absolutely. I actually remembered Red Star better than they really were. Watching the first leg back, I was surprised how good Bayern were for some spells in this game. I just remember Red Star just being this unbelievable team, but they had enough for Bayern in the first leg. And then,
well, I think it's worth talking about the first leg, because the first leg is a great match. So Wolfart puts Bayern ahead. Great, it's a lovely goal. Mm. Little three ball, little sort of like little flick with the inside of his heel from Tone for Wolfhart, who then just dinks it over
Stojanovic. Yes, a great goal.
And yet probably only the third best goal in the game, despite being a brilliant goal.
Well, Bayern were kind of sucker punched, really, by the two attacks afterwards.
The speed of the breakaway for the equaliser, which is just before half time. So Laudrup's been getting a right kicking from Maravich.
Oh, he got some right treatment over the two.
And Maravich was a, even in a Serbian context, he was seen as being a tough man. And so Maravich, he'd got booked. I think he'd been booked for about his fifth terrible foul on Laudrup.
Oh, he'd been off nowadays.
But as soon as he gets booked, he starts playing properly. And he's actually was a really good defender as well. Mm. And so he reads the through ball. I think it's Tone's through ball to Laudrup. He reads it, dispossesses him, plays inside to Belotadic, who was a beautiful footballer.
Yeah.
And he plays it to Poznański, who plays this fantastic pass, 60-yard curling pass down the line, perfectly weighted, to Grisha Binic, who by his own admission was quick but couldn't really play football, sprints onto it, puts it across the back post, and Panchev coming in. It's the most... I just don't know how you defend against... Unless you just never attack, you can't stop that kind of break.
I think you can stop it in modern times when you defend more as a unit. I mean,
in those days.
When this is one of the really surprising things for me watching those old games from, they're not that old, but the spaces available, it's just
completely
incredible.
I mean, not that, it's 30 years ago.
I know,
it's
but the game is
history.
So different.
Yeah,
the game,
you're right.
So different.
I completely agree.
When you no longer see sort of strikers running from the halfway line towards the goalkeeper, completely unopposed, which happened all the time. Then.
Yeah, it's true. And that is what brings the Zvezda winner, as it turned out.
Correct.
But that Stojanovic called that Zvezda's moment of destiny, because there's a cross whipped in, which I think it's Maravich on the chest, but it when you first see it, it looks like it could be handball. Mm-hmm. And so there's huge appeals for penalty. It goes out for a corner. Reuter then scores from the corner, so pokes it into the back post, and the referee's already blown for push by Agüntala, which really is not obvious. Zvezda lose the ball from a free kick, and then Effenberg gives it away, and Bayern have somehow got sucked forward as if sort of being denied the penalty, having this goal ruled out mysteriously, they sort of mess with their heads. And is it Poznański or Jugovic, I can't remember, who plays the ball through, and Savicevic runs on. And he's alone in the Bayern half. And then the finish is actually very like Mark Hughes' finish against Barcelona in the Cup Winners' Cup final.
Yeah.
The ball sort of pops up. And he could easily have kind of screwed it somewhere, but no, he absolutely smashes it into the bottom corner. It's a brilliant finish.
What was when they came to town, you know, Bayern had drawn against them. They were Bayern on the road. They'd beaten Porto on the way there, of course, the side that had beaten them a few years previously in the final. Now, we know the story goes, because Vesta beat Rangers on the way, and as the story goes, Walter Smith went over to scout for...
As soon as
and came back with a two-word report, just said, "We're fucked." You know, when he scouted Red Star, and was a bit like, you know, this side are pretty decent.
And sure enough, they found themselves 3-0 down in about an hour.
And sure enough, obviously, Red Star went through quite handedly. But did Bayern, when Red Star turned up, what was the thinking with Bayern? Did they think, well, we should have enough here? Or were they aware of the sort of reputation?
Well, I asked Raymond Aumann, who, of course, maybe is the critical figure now this, as far as the second leg is concerned. You know, how did you go into this game? Was there an assumption that this is just going to be, you know, a walkover because Bayern are Bayern and these guys are a Red Star? Hmm. And he was adamant that they knew about these players.
Well, they had played Köln in the UEFA Cup the year before. So, I mean, that itself is actually quite significant for two reasons, one of which we'll come to later. But the specific reason, they were 2-0 up and end up losing it 3-2. And Dragoslav Sekulovac, who was one of the greatest of Zvezda's players ever, was the manager. And he slapped a steward as this kind of capitulation is going on, got banned for 8 games. And that was the official reason for him being sacked and being replaced by Jukka Pekovic. Mm. But there was also perception he just wasn't really kind of a great coach.
Yeah.
But nobody wanted to say that of one of the club's legends. And Sekulovac, he died 2 or 3 years ago. I interviewed him. It's one of the weirdest interviews I've ever done, because I went to his flat, and you get old footballers often say, yeah, just come around my house. But he was literally dying of cancer and just lying in bed, and he couldn't get out of bed.
Oh,
and there's that sort of stench of death around the place. And he was, the only thing he did, like, all through the interview, he was just fuming about how bad Manchester United were. I was talking to him about.
This is a very recent interview.
It was just before he died, 3 or 4 years ago.
Which was it? Van Hal's Majesty and
I. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah,
I love that. Still angry.
But I think I must have been talking to him because he played in the game in 58, the last game before the Munich air crash, you know, the game they were coming back from when he crashed. I think that's why I went to talk to him.
Okay.
And he sort of said from then he'd have this love of United and he would always, it didn't matter who they were playing, he'd always bet on them to win. Mm. And he started losing loads of money because they stopped winning games. And whatever, you know, sort of whatever question I asked, he drew it back to kind of, why are United so bad? but anyway, that's Shaquille O'Neal. He got sacked for this game against Cologne.
For Rafa, you're going to say?
Yeah, so Almond said, yeah, we knew they were one of the best teams in Europe. We had seen games. I think they had been briefed. But still, I think you can't help but be influenced by what's going on around you. And very much the press and the fans were all thought, you know, this is Bayern's year, possibly. You know, they're playing well. They have the World Cup winners. This is a really decent team. They had nice balance. There were some issues that we can talk about for the second leg as well about Augenthaler's position because he was a very aging player and he was still playing sweeper. And initially, Heynckes was thinking, how can I get him out of the team? Because I don't want to play with a sweeper anymore. But in the end, ironically enough, Augenthaler himself, before the second leg, said, in a clandestine meeting that they had between themselves, the players, I'm going to go into midfield and I'm going to mark Prosinecki. And when Heynckes found out, he was really, really unhappy. Mm. And he was back as a sweeper for the second leg.
Right, okay.
So the assumption, and I think there was a line about the team being made of silk, which, you know, has connotations. The opposition, Red Star. In the German press, which has connotations of beauty and everything, but a little
fragility
bit, a little bit lightweight and probably not enough for this Bayern team, which made the
Jeez,
first
imagine
leg...
Imagine calling Slobodan Maravich lightweight.
Yeah, no, which made the first leg all the more dramatic. And I think what's important to understand for maybe younger listeners is that in those days, if you lost your home game, it was basically seen as
you're
the
in big
end.
Trouble.
It's the end. Yeah. Even a 1-1 draw is sort of the end. I mean, those, you're thinking, you know, you have to go away from home. There is just no way you can turn these things around. Every game, when you come back from a bad result, a 1-1 or a defeat, is a miracle at that stage. And Bayern went into the second leg thinking about the miracle and we have to do some extraordinary amount of football and good fortune. It's completely different to what we think about, you know, in these days when teams play each other all the time. Well, it doesn't really matter that anymore.
The emphasis on away goals was far greater back then, which is why the away goals rule came in.
Well, and teams would... I still remember very well Bayern would go into these games against British opposition. For 5 years in a row, they were knocked out by British opposition or lost the final with Villa. So from, I think, 1980 to 1985, every single time they came up against British opposition, they lost. And they would go into these games, especially away from, thinking, you know what? Yeah, if we lose 2-1, that's a great result. I mean, that was the thinking at the time, even as German champions. And so the 2-1 was seen as a complete disaster.
Yeah, well, a previous Greatest Games pod, when we spoke to James Horncastle about Milan going away to Zvezda, they drew the game 1-1.
And that was seen as being an the 1-1 draw in the Maracanã was then seen as this incredible, barely comprehensible result.
But they thought they'd thrown it away, having drawn 1-1 at home.
Yeah.
Even though they're all to play for. Now, we listen to that one back. We won't go into that.
But I mean, one thing we should say is that although there was only sort of, I think, 5 players who played in that Milan game played in this game, one of the players who was missing was Dragan Stojkovic.
Yeah.
So they'd upgraded in every area. But Stojkovic is the huge star who leaves.
Well, he left for Marseille, of course.
So Zvezda have this thing, the Zvezdina Zvezda, so the stars of a star, which only 6 have ever been awarded. Shaquille O'Neal is one, Stojkovic is one, and then the 6th one is awarded to this team in its entirety because it obviously goes on to win the European Cup.
Absolutely.
So Stojkovic, his departure was a huge blow for them. But actually... He was replaced by, I think he was 21 at the time, Vladimir Jugovic, who, hugely talented player, played much deeper in midfield, and that liberates Prosinecki. So he becomes much more of a playmaker. So it's one of those things where you lose your great player, but actually it makes you a much better balanced side.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the game then in the second half. Back in a moment.
Radinović je prevario Štrunca. Radinović prema Pančevu. Pančevu u sredinu. Binić! Šansa za...
The Best of the Blizzard is out now. A perfect Christmas gift, I think so. 23 of our favourite pieces from the first 5 years of the Blizzard for you, friends and loved ones. Everything from Socrates and Scotland to St. Pauli and football smoking culture. Head to the shop now to buy The Best of the Blizzard at theblizzard.co.uk.
Laudrup do Tona. Ton, prema volta al tuevo, Filike. Sada su pokovi bili na strani crvene zvezde. Filić.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to Greatest Games, everybody. Now then, we've talked a little bit about the first leg. Let's get down to the second leg. They're at the wonderfully named Maracanã Stadium in Belgrade. And, of course, Red Star 2-1 up. Two away goals. The mood is good, it's fair to say. And, of course, Jonathan, Yugoslavia, the national side, had choked a few times in previous sort of tournaments, and Yugoslav club sides had not, they'd got sort of latter stages a little bit, but no one had quite got there. They were known for sort of choking, because if you think about those sides in history, they should have had their name
well,
on the
trophy. Well, let's go through it. They lost in three Olympic finals.
Right.
They lost in, that was the national team. Mm-hmm. The national team had lost in the Euro finals in 60 and 68. Mm-hmm. Partizan had lost to Real Madrid in the 66 final, a game about which there's millions of conspiracy theories. Zvezda had lost to Borussia Mönchengladbach in the 79 UEFA Cup final. Five Serbian teams had lost in semi-finals of a European Cup. Yugoslavia lost in the semi-finals of the World Cup in 1930 and 1962. And Zvezda themselves, the previous year, had been 2-0 up against Köln and had chucked it away. Mm. And it was definitely within that Zvezda side. I remember talking to Savicevic about this, and Savicevic is a difficult man to interview because he will not focus at all. But he was saying that one of the things that struck them about the first leg was how they saw, sort of 5-10 minutes to go, Bayern fans began to leave the stadium, and they sort of felt, as that happened, this is incredible, because they had this perception, and this might be Savicevic creating a memory later on, but the thing he mentioned was, his perception was German teams fight to the end, and this was the sense that they'd given up.
Wow, Rafa's dying to say something.
I should admit, I would have been one of those fans 10 minutes early, but it had nothing to do with the game. because in the old Olympic Stadium, you had about 15 minutes to walk until you got to your car.
Okay.
And if you only left for the final whistle, you'd stay in a traffic jam for about 2 hours. So going with my dad and my grandfather, who was a little bit slow at that time already, we would always go, no matter what the result, 10 or maybe sometimes 15 minutes early, would send the grandfather first and catch up with him later. And we must have missed, in those 10 years, literally hundreds of goals. But it was still better than standing in the car for 2 hours.
Well, Savicevic didn't realise this, and he took a great... Yeah, psychological sucker.
Sorry, Dave.
From this site of
whatever you can do to create any sort of propaganda. Blimey. So they go into the game. So Rafa, just what was the mood then among Bayern? Were they going into this game thinking, well, let's try and obviously trying to win the game, but did they have serious hopes, or were they thinking, right, hang on a minute, let's try and create almost as a mini miracle here?
Yeah, it was definitely talk of a miracle. There was that meeting that Augenthaler called in his basement. Those days, everyone had a disco basement, you know, where you had a little bar and
everybody should
probably a mini dance floor as well. I don't know if Augenthaler had a dance floor; he doesn't strike me as that kind of guy. But they certainly had some drinks, and those were the days where you'd met without the coach to sort of get together and pull together. I mean, this was a difficult dressing room with the likes of Effenberg and Thorn and Bender. A lot of big characters, but maybe not the sort of the best team in terms of the spirit. But they decided, you know what, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity here. We need to pull together, need to make something happen. And they had this tactical debate. Ultimately, it was thwarted. And Heynckes was already having a sort of tenuous grip on authority. Later on, Effenberg, when Heynckes was fired the next season, I think it's that year when Effenberg, or when it came out that Effenberg had this nickname Osram for Heynckes. Now, Osram were the manufacturers of the most popular light bulbs. Because he would say that Heynckes' head would turn red like a light bulb when he got angry. But that showed you just how Lowell's standing was, at least with some of the players. And yeah, as we said a second ago, it really was seen as this almost impossible task. And there was a lot, I think, well, maybe not a lot, but there was some reference being made to this UEFA Cup quarterfinal, I think it was, against Inter, that Bayern had turned around. That had gone down as a miracle in 1989, with Aumann being probably the best Aumann we'd ever seen at the San Siro. And that was a game that Bayern won in the second leg, having lost at home. And something extremely extraordinary to the same sort of level would have to happen for Bayern to go through to the final.
Yeah. So the game gets underway. And as you say, Jonathan, you know, the whole sort of background.
The atmosphere is extraordinary.
Yeah.
But this great, it's a very odd thing that the tunnel is not in the middle at the American Arena. It's behind one of the goals. And as they come up the steps, the camera there looking at the players come up the steps. And on the lintel, as they come out, it's just graffiti. Just something just scrawled Zvezda.
Yeah.
And everybody's sort of touching it like it's the Liverpool badge at Anfield. Yeah. And it's literally just somebody with a bit of paint. It's not even neatly done.
Yeah. Oh, so it's graffiti almost.
It is graffiti.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not an official club thing, but it sort of, I don't know, it suggests the wildness of Belgrade at the time.
Yeah.
Kind of, and also, I guess, the connection between fans and players, if you want to spin it positively. But this was a, you know, it was a febrile city and a febrile stadium in a febrile city. And,
And as you say, the climate at the time in the country, you can't...
dissociate that.
You can't. And also, you can't, I mean,
people,
sort of state
people
it enough.
Say, people who lived in Belgrade in that decade said that they've simultaneously never been as scared, never had such a good time.
Yeah.
That everybody went out every night and got absolutely hammered because you didn't know if you're going to survive the next day. I mean, that might not have been quite the case at this stage, but certainly by the time the bombings had started.
But it's influencing the atmosphere in the stadium and that kind of cauldron atmosphere. And you can't overstate it enough how difficult it was for Bayern, having already been 2-1 down, to go into that very foreign surrounding in every sort of sense of the word.
Yeah, and then what happens, out, 24 minutes in,
yeah,
Savicevic had come in for a bit of treatment, gets fouled by, I think, Struntz. So there's a free kick, sort of 30 yards out, 25 yards out, and Sniš Mihailović who's playing in midfield, playing as a left winger.
But yeah, you think obviously Sinisa Mihajlovic for years played as a sweeper or a centre half at least,
or a left back, or but he was playing on left wing.
Yeah, with his flowing hair.
Yeah, nicknamed Barbika because he had these sort of fluffy curls, and he's only 22, but he looks younger. He's got quite a little chubby face.
But he was still scoring free kicks in the early days.
Free kick just clips the end of the wall. It's stunts in the end of the wall. It clips, isn't it? And wrong foot Aumann goes in. But his celebration, you sort of see. I've got this sort of fascination with Mihajlovic. It's obviously kind of some difficult parts of his personality. But he's a kid who's come from Brovosello. He's got a Serbian father, Croatian mother. He is sort of the epitome of everything that was difficult about Yugoslavia at the time. Mm. He'd spend his childhood smashing free kicks against the gate at home, so his dad had to replace the gate every few months. The neighbours hated him. I can't remember when it was now, but it was before one of those Serbia-Croatia World Cup qualifiers when he was managing Serbia, and I went to Brovosello and I found his maths teacher and somebody who taught him PE, and they were also like, well, he's obviously brilliant footballer, but a complete tearaway. And the neighbours sort of hated him because he just every day just thudding this ball against the gate. But
practice pays off.
He scored a goal in the European Cup semi-final. Yeah. And he runs away with sort of this huge grin on his face and sort of just clapping as if he's in the stands. And he'd for the game against the Grasshoppers in the first round, he had paid for a ticket. Because he hadn't been, he'd only joined 3 months earlier from Vojvodina in Novi Sad. And he said before the game, as he was sort of stretching, leaning against the concrete in the tunnel to stretch, he'd felt the concrete shaking with the atmosphere. And he thought to himself, Sinisa, what are you doing? Why didn't you just stay in Novi Sad and have a quiet life?
Well, so Resta go 1-0 up. And as you say, the scene's a celebration. It's very much, hey, this is going to be a nice, relaxing game. We're on the way to the final.
A 1-0 lead, 3-1 lead, 2 away goals.
And then they created some chances. And as you said earlier, Rafa, but sometimes watching games back then, the space that was there and the way Zvezda moved the ball around, it was almost, we talked about on a previous, but it was an element, I don't want to overstate it too much, but it was almost like the first half or the first bit of the first half of like the 1974 World Cup final, the way they're knocking the ball about, creating chances. They looked sort of superior to Bayern. They looked comfortable.
They're totally comfortable.
Technically magnificent. The pace they had in the side, as you say, they've got some tough guys in there. They looked like they could do everything. But of course, it wasn't to be, and so it was 1-0 at half time.
1-0 at half time, and then Zvezda could have gone. They had a very good chance 2 minutes after half time.
Yeah.
When Panchev is wrongly flagged offside, I don't think he even got the shot off, but he was clean through.
Mm-hmm.
So if they'd gone 2-0 up, who knows? But they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bayern started getting back into it. Wolfhard has that incredible chance that Tolan basically just has to square it to him, and he pulls it back slightly too far, and Wolfhard's reaching for it. But you see from Stojanovic's reaction, Stojanovic thinks he scored because the cross has gone past Stojanovic. Mm. Wolfhard sort of just drags it a fraction wide. And even when you're watching it on telly, it's not, you just assume he scored when you first see it. You think he must score. It's not quite clear. And you realise he's missed. It's unbelievable miss.
Yeah.
But that's the start of this real Bayern surge in the second half.
Yeah, so the German efficiency kicks in eventually. Although they were given a helping hand with the...
I wouldn't call them efficient.
Well, they come back
into
the game.
I think there's a bit of... It's just a winning mentality that kicks in at that moment because you are basically beating...
Well, their winning mentality and Zvezda's total fragility.
Mm.
Yeah, and I don't know. I would have to ask one of the players again. I don't know how much they sensed it, but sometimes you can.
I think they did.
Because
you see the game, there's sort of 10 minutes when it's just an absolute, I mean, I'm trying to think of a different metaphor because it's inappropriate in the context, but an absolute bombardment. It's just chance after chance after chance after chance. And you see Zvezda collapsing. It's the sort of, so wait a minute, the Bayern pull, they equalise on the night, they get to within one with an Aguantara free kick that goes,
maybe could have been saved.
It's a dreadful goal kick.
Yeah. It's not struck particularly cleanly.
Yeah.
It's straight at Stojanovic and it just sort of, it's all horrible. Just squirms under his body, through his legs. Stojanovic is a very nice man. He's very good at saving penalties.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he's a very good agent to the players. He's an agent too at the moment. But he did have a mistake in him.
Oh man, that was a bad one. But as you say, John, the history of Yugoslav teams choking and failing.
It's like there's ghosts coming out of the pitch to kind of remind them.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, it's sort of, if you want to, go back to historical precedence, at that point, it's basically Germany, France in the 1982 semi-final where Germany are beaten, they've got nothing left to lose, and suddenly France realise, oh no, you know, what happens if we now lose after having scored all these goals and we're comfortable here? And I think that sort of momentum kicks in. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this Bayern team, this was another thing that was interesting to see watching back this game. This was before teams had really sort of symmetrical lineups, because there were men marking, or at least Bayern were, so you didn't have to be in straight lines. So one guy was playing further up, the guy on the right was playing further back. I mean, it was a bit of a mishmash in terms of how they positioned themselves. But what this team had, they didn't have real wingers in the side, but what they had was a lot of powerful midfielders. This was very much sort of a midfield team, and they would often rely on that power to just basically keep running and running.
So Reuter, Stunz, Effenberg is the sort of heart of the midfield.
Yeah, and then you've got Bender, who's not really sort of an orthodox
bombing on
winger,
from left back.
But yeah, he's kind of sort of a Peter Briegel kind of character, maybe slightly more technical, but not really a winger in how we think of wingers in these days. And that kind of power and that kind of sort of muscle at that moment becomes very, very dominant and sort of asserts itself against a side that cannot really keep the ball anymore, against a side that just maybe starts doubting themselves a little bit. Suddenly Bayern have the upper hand without necessarily playing, I think, brilliant football, but just kind of throwing man forward in this belief that we can still do it.
Yeah, so the Augenthaler goal, 61 minutes and 66 minutes, an Effenberg cross goes over two players. Shabanadzovic is clearly unsighted. The ball just bounces off him, and Bender coming in from the left lashes it in off the post. It's a really good finish. And you sort of, you almost see Svejda melt of this sort of, oh, we had it and it's gone.
It's such a turnaround.
Yeah. And then actually I think the moment that flips it back, not to being Svejda on top, because it's never on top again in the game, but to being at least equal, is just after that Tone plays to Ivolfati. Very similar to the goal he scored in the first leg. Little dink over the keeper.
Oh, Rafa's sunk in his seat.
And like, as you see it go over the keeper, there's no way that ball doesn't go in. Stojanovic, you can see him beginning to beat the ground because he thinks it's in. And it just drifts in the air, then hits the pitch and just turns like a leg break and hits the post and goes wide.
But the funny thing is, when it hits the post...
There's no funny thing about it.
No, absolutely not. When the ball hits the post, as you say, it's going in, and then at last second, it doesn't. But Effenberg's coming in for the follow-up. I think it's Effenberg. There's a Bayern player. But of course, the way the ball hits the angle, it bounces out just beyond him.
Can we move on?
You know, so it's an enormous slice of luck for Zvezda. They got away. It was such a let-off.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Stojanovic is he's so expressive. You can see... Yeah, you can see between the ball going over him and hitting the post, the way he's just turned and his fist is up to punch the ground.
Yeah.
And then, they realise this is the reprieve.
And that would have been it.
And they find this, because it would have been another away goal, obviously.
Exactly. That would have been the game over.
And they find this, I don't even know what it is, but some other level, some other part of themselves, where they can't control the game again. They're not settled enough to do that. They're not emotionally stable enough to do that. But at least they can attack.
It was rather open last 20
minutes. And that last 20 minutes is the most extraordinary 20 minutes of football. It's just attack after attack after attack, one way then the other. And
But it's a freak goal that wins the game.
Do you think?
Yeah, well, but it's just like... it was a rather fortuitous one, certainly. But the quality on the pitch, you look at the players and the football and the goals that have already been scored and the context of it, blah-dy, blah-dy, blah. That goal!
So the 90th minute... it's actually been a really nice stage to move, and it ends with Prosineski playing it wide to Mihailovic. And Mihailovic is a very good cross of the ball. We know he's a very good striker of the ball.
Yeah.
Not so much on this occasion. So he scuffs this cross into the box, and it misses Panchev, and Argentala's got all the time in the world to do whatever he wants with it, control it, knock it behind for a corner.
He's a little bit on his... His weight is on his left leg.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
so
that's
he's
true.
Stretching for the ball with his
right foot
and doesn't get a proper connection.
And he tries to boot it back where it's come from and slices it, and it goes miles in the air. Mm. And so you think Raymond Amelin goal's got loads of time to just sort of pluck it out of the air as it comes down, because he's not under pressure. There's nobody, you haven't got Panchev coming in with his elbows up or anything.
There's a player near him, but yeah, still.
He's not going to get clattered.
There's no real challenge.
It's not Nat Loftus.
No.
And the ball drops, and you suddenly realise Amman's legs have got stuck.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of...
He never really jumps up.
Yeah,
he's such an odd
just
one.
His feet are just totally rooted, and he's
It's not like he's stepping back and back and back. He's plopped over his head.
He's completely misjudged the flight of the ball, which perhaps is understandable because the connection from Argenthal is so freakishly bad that it spins in a sort of an arc,
with
a back spin.
Mm.
You wouldn't be able to replicate
that
specific clearance, if you can call it that, if you tried 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And Augenthaler's just not ready for it. He just thinks this is going to go over, this is going to go, you know, anywhere, but suddenly it drops just over his head and into the goal. And
there is
this moment of
silence. Yeah, exactly.
Before people understand.
Because it feels like several seconds of, you know, you're sort of processing it of, that ball's dropping under the bar.
Yeah.
The keeper is stuck.
Yep.
His arms aren't going to get there.
Yep. But it's like the referee's blown his whistle while the ball's midair. And the goalkeeper just kind of let it in, almost. There's an element of that.
But because you can see him struggling and his feet just won't move. His weight off, he's just totally in the wrong place and he can't.
And then all hell breaks
loose. And then it sort of just dribbles over him and in.
Yeah.
And I think people in the ground can't have quite believed what they've seen.
No one can believe what they've seen because this is just, you know, for a German team as well, to concede that kind of goal.
But that match as well.
It's just unbelievable.
End to end, as I say, the quality on show, the goals that have been scored. When something like that happens, but when it does sink in to the home faithful and the players, you have this incredible explosion of celebration. The substitutes are on the pitch. Prozinecki, as he's hugging a bloke, tries to almost sort of rip his head off in raw emotion. It's extraordinary.
The commentary you hear him go,
oh yeah,
dva, dva. And then you can hear his throat kind of close up and he can't quite, and then he just starts going, goal, goal, goal. But he's totally hoarse by this point. And then there's a few seconds of play left in which he just lists the face of the team. He doesn't do any other commentary. He's just going, Dragisha Binic. Binic is nowhere near the ball. Sinisha Mikhailovic. Just listing the heroes.
But they've got
then the pitch invasion at the end.
Hmm.
The German commentary is worse. The German commentator, Uli Potofsky, was RTL, one of the commercial channels that was just really gone on air a couple of years before, and they had the rights. And Bayern are attacking. I think there was sort of 2 minutes of injury time.
Yeah,
there.
Something like that. Yeah,
and they do get forward, and of course, a third Bayern goal puts them through.
Yeah,
but Uli Potofsky doesn't know this for some reason, and says, "Oh well, Bayern attacking. Yeah, but it wouldn't matter anyway." And he says this a second time, and then you see, well, you don't see, but you see that there's a pause, and then he goes, yeah, well, actually, of course, it would have been fine, the second goal, but it's too late now.
All right.
They're out.
Thanks very much. And that's the kind of insight.
It's not just because I saw this game recently again, but also do remember, and I know a lot of people who watched this game felt the same, they were screaming at the television at this point. Because you know you always get upset with a commentator when your team is losing. For whatever he does wrong, you kind of think, okay, at least I can vent my anger at him. And people were screaming, screaming at the screen at that moment, saying, what are you talking about? It wouldn't be enough.
Taking the sting out the moment. But they got over the line, Jonathan.
And then and the pitch invasion is one of the most hysterical, euphoric.
Yeah.
And they, if you go to Serbia now, you will... Zvezda fans who are there will take you out into the garden and show you the little foot of grass they might
have. Is it
the
sort of scenario where 300,000 people claim to be
in the stadium?
Much like the one true cross turned out to be about 8 miles high. So this pitch was several thousand hectares.
Exactly.
Everyone's got a piece.
Yeah, but as you say, it was the last sort of...
The last great game of a Yugoslav side. And obviously the end of Yugoslavia as a nation and...
But
it's the last great game they to play because the final they won it was not a great game. There's all kinds of reasons for that,
indeed,
which we're not entirely allowed to talk about.
which is a great shame, but absolutely right.
But they do win the European Cup.
Yeah,
they win it on penalties, and Stojanovic, he'd had a pretty nightmarish semi-final, has a very, very good final, and he's the captain. And then the team breaks up, and Although they're actually within one game of reaching the final again the following year, but incredibly, because I think they lost to like eight players. It's just everybody's dispersed because everybody wants to get out of Yugoslavia, and footballers clearly have an ability to get out that other people don't have.
Yeah, but in pure footballing terms, it was amazing for those fans to see that game in that stadium and then go on to win the European Cup in the last.
Yeah, and I still think that last 20 minutes of that second leg, I mean, I don't know if the full game's on YouTube, and I got a VHS tape I bought in Belgrade years ago.
Well, we'll all come round yours.
Yeah, but please do. and bring a VHS player because I no longer have one of them. But I still think that's the greatest 20 minutes of football I've ever seen. I can almost get emotional thinking about it because it's just so good.
Yeah. Well, high praise indeed, Jonathan. Well, Rafa, we'll put you out of your misery now if you want.
I just wanted to say I think I hinted upon this earlier, but this is also the breakup of the Bayern side.
Right, okay.
Because the next season, there is still a bit of a hangover from that defeat. Kohler and Reuter get sold to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Effenberg and Laudrup are only there for another year, and they go. Heynckes gets fired.
Yeah, Laudrup didn't play in the second leg. Do you know why that was?
No, I don't remember.
I mean, I know
he might have been seen as a little bit lightweight.
I was going to say,
he got a right kicking in the first leg.
He had a reputation for sort of not turning up when it really got going. But technically, it was an unbelievable player. But so Heynckes gets fired the next season, and Bayern appoint Søren Larby, former Bayern player, Danish midfielder, as a caretaker. Larby, I think, is in charge for three or four games. It's an absolute disaster. Can't talk, can't express himself. Like the worst coaching appointment ever. And Bayern are flirting with relegation all of a sudden. They're in 12th place, they're in 13th place. They get knocked out by Brøndby in the UEFA Cup. 6-2, they lose the first game. So it's a team and a club sort of in 3-4. And then they appoint Erich Ribbeck, who's kind of saves them and steadies them. But it's a historic season, the season after, because they're so bad that Uli Hoeneß, who's been in charge as a general manager since 1979, without anyone really overlooking what he does, and he's the guy who gets all the decisions right and always buys the good players and everything, is getting challenged, and they are forced to bring in Rummenigge and Beckenbauer into the club as president and vice president because there's so much opposition against Hoeneß. And that is actually the big blessing in disguise.
That's
because
the start of
that extra bit of know-how and stature and sort of a slightly different approach to many things then really builds the foundation for Bayern to go to a completely new level over the next 20 years or so. But it all starts with that defeat.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, there you are, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening to Greatest Games. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Rafa Honigstein and Jonathan, as always. We're back next week, of course, with the Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. See you soon.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this yeah. shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.